Work session number 14257, Reel 2.
Mr. Raleigh, Reel 2.
The strip was a dirt strip, about 400 yards long, I should think, with hills, small hills at either side. So at times, taking off, if you got a load of very heavy men on board, the idea was as soon as you got airborne, you turned slightly to get to the main road and flew down the main road to gain height, rather than try and climb over the hill at the end. And we were stationed with the 2nd and 7th Gurkhas, who were stationed at the camp at that time, Paroi Camp.
Which camp?
Paroi, P-A-R-O-I, Paroi Camp.
And what did you think of the Gurkha unit you were attached to?
Oh, excellent chaps. Very good chaps. There's only one drawback we had with them. They'd had as you know, the Gurkhas received their, during the war or any time, they received their rations live, and they have to kill it and get on with it. These Gurkhas, during the Burma campaign, they'd had this little goat dropped to them, baby goat, and of course they'd be all our little baby thing, we're not going to kill this, so they kept it. By the time we were joined them at Paroi, this goat was about the size of a donkey and got great big horns on. And across the other side of the strip from where we lived was the rifleman's canteen. And quite regular occasions, the Gurkhas would get a few bit merry with the old tiger beer and feed the goat with the tiger beer. And all at once you'd see these little Gurkhas popping out of the windows. The goat had gone berserk inside, charging up and down. But it had the freedom of the camp, this goat. It used to sort of walk around parades and all things like that.
You said it was the 2nd, 7th?
2nd, 7th, yeah.
Can you describe your own duties, the tasks you performed?
Our main task at that time was mainly liaison, ferrying people up and down the country. We did the odd Kazivak, but with a Oster, there wasn't really a lot of room. We had a special stretcher that we made, which more or less made out of sort of bamboo slats and canvas, and you more or less wrapped it round the chap to keep him very stable, and then sort of tried to work it into the back of an Oster, but it wasn't really ideal for that. We did a little bit, in those days, a little bit of target marking, but it was very rudimentary. What it consisted of, really, was we would find a target for the aircraft, and I remember doing it for vampires. And the idea was that the vampires would circle around above the target, and then when you give the word, the Oster would fly down in a screaming dive full out, doing about 90 knots, and with a Berry pistol fire out of the window to mark the target, whereupon the vampires would then dive down on this Berry pistol and start blazing away with cannons. So you can imagine how you felt in the Oster, going like a bat out of hell across the treetops trying to get out the way of the vampires. I think we were in more danger than the enemy. But that was one thing we did. Contact with patrols. If a patrol got in the jungle and they got lost, that kind of thing, we would fly over the area and ask them to put smoke up, and then we could find them and more or less tell them the best way to come out to the road or things like this, for the transport to meet them, this kind of thing. And of course, photography. We did a lot of photography because we used to search for bandit camps, which were very difficult to find. But now and then you would come across a clearing, because the bandits did a lot of gardening to produce their things. So you would look for clearings in the middle of the jungle and take photographs of them. And then they could be attacked or sprayed or whatever they did with them, or send troops in to destroy them. So PR, photographs were another business. One of my weirdest things, I was flying one day from Singapore up to Seremban, and I was asked to go to a place called Bahau, which was the other side of the mountain from Seremban. And I landed, there was a golf course there, and the Gurkhas were, I think it was the Gurkhas, were in charge, and they asked me if I'd pick up a parcel. So I landed there, and I was given this Hessian sack, rather like a sandbag. And I put it over my shoulder and started walking back to the aircraft, and I said to the officer who'd given me it, "What's in here then?" So he said, "Oh, 5 heads. And at that time, this was early on in the emergency, all the terrorists who were killed had to be identified. So they chopped the heads off and sent the heads back to be identified. Later on, I think the Daily Mirror got hold of this and made a big scream about it. So after, because you see, you had to identify, and you couldn't carry a body out, it would be rotten anyway. So after that, they had to take in cameras and photograph them.
Was the sack bloody?
No, it wasn't. Well, I think they dried out. It was a weird feeling to be carrying heads in the back of the aircraft.
Which of these jobs that you've described did you prefer?
I liked working with patrols, because you then felt that you'd really achieve something, especially if the patrols were in a really bad way and were desperate to get out, and you could pick them up and direct them out to get them out. It's a nice feeling when you can do something like that and get a result from it, as it were.
And the job which you disliked most?
Well, I wouldn't say I disliked any job, really, because I enjoyed flying. I always enjoyed flying, so I enjoyed any job, as far as I was concerned, really. If I wasn't doing it, there was some point for the job, otherwise you wouldn't be doing it. So even if it was a fact of just flying someone from A to B, you knew, in fact, that if he hadn't have gone by air, especially in those days, early on, a lot of the areas were what were called black, so there was a chance of being attacked by terrorists. Also, it would take him far longer to go by road, much more uncomfortable than flying there. So even though it was sort of on the boring side, just flying up and down, at least you knew that as far as your passenger was concerned, you were saving him a lot of time and a lot of trouble. So there were no jobs, really, that weren't worth doing.
Did you ever get any ground fire?
No, we never did, no. I don't recall any. We lost a lot of aircraft. The Oster wasn't made for the Far East. And one problem we had was the propellers, which were wood. And they flew off at one time fairly regularly. And what was happening was the aircraft were parked outside at night, and the damp was getting into the woodwork and causing it to expand. And as it expanded, it stretched the bolt slightly. Then when you started flying next day, that would dry out, and so the propeller was sort of loose, and it was moving backwards and forwards on the bolt, and eventually the heat set in, and they split, and they flew off. And after that, well, when they finally found out what the problem was, the holding bolts were tightened every day. And then I think it was about once a week or once every 3 or 4 days, something like that, the propeller was taken off and inspected at the back to see if there were any cracks in it. But we lost quite a few until they got over that. And it was underpowered, of course, especially with the heat. It was underpowered.
Did you take any special kit in case you did come down in the jungle?
Yes, we had a survival pack, which was carried in the back of the aircraft, which was supposed to carry change of clothing, rations, spare socks, and he had a rifle, of course, a No. 5 rifle was to carry with us. But I actually came down in the jungle.
How did it happen?
I was stationed at Taiping at the time. We'd moved up North Malaya, and I was on a recce up in the mountainous area north of Taiping, and I turned into a valley, and I suppose in some ways it's my own fault, but I was fairly new out there at that time. I hadn't been fully briefed, and I couldn't get out. Couldn't get out of this valley. Couldn't climb out. There wasn't enough power. So I settled into the top of the trees, and the aircraft settled in the top of the trees and then dropped through onto the ground. And when I got to the survival pack, the only things that were in were Horlicks tablets. It had been rifled. Stuff had been taken out. And there's a tube of Horlicks tablets, and we had a smoke grenade, which was a big grenade, like a smoke bomb, really. And a Vary pistol, which I took from the aircraft, and my rifle. And then I was 3 days walking out before I came out of the jungle.
What was that like?
Horrible. Absolutely terrible. Because in those days, we used to fly in shorts and shoes. Didn't wear jungle boots, and we didn't have long trousers. So, and it was a mountainous area. By the time I come out, I'd lost all my tops of my fingernails through scrambling over, up and down the hills. And with having shoes and socks on, I'd get loads of leeches. And in fact, every so often, you would just stop and get a handful of leeches out your socks. Just pull them out. So, and we'd no food, only Horlicks tablets. And when I actually came, when I finally came out to a police post, a Malayan police post, when we finally got there, and the first thing the chap offered me was a cup of Horlicks.
Who were you with?
A Malay policeman. They were called Tiger Force, and we were doing a recce for him to take his platoon into this area. The hardest thing I had with him was to try and convince him that water ran downhill. He couldn't see this. My idea was, we were talking about getting out, and my idea was to walk down, or get down the best we could from where we were, to the main river, because we'd flown up this main river, so we knew the main river was there. Then when we hit the main river, to follow the river down, and that would bring us out into the low country. And he just couldn't see this. I couldn't get through to him that this is what we had to do, to go down to this river and then to follow the river down, and we'd get out of the mountains. And I don't know why, he just couldn't see it. And it wasn't until actually we almost out of the jungle and it suddenly dawned on him what I'd been talking about. But he couldn't see it.
What nationality was
he? He was English. He was English, ex-National Serviceman, who'd been attached. These people, been National Serviceman, gone back to Malaya, joined the Malay police, and of course immediately they were given two pips and put in charge of these jungle patrols.
So what was his strategy for getting
out? I had no idea, really. He just. I don't think he had a plan at all. I don't think he'd give it any real thought about how he was going to go about it. I think he was trying to think about going over mountains and all this kind of thing, which is rubbish. Never got out that way.
Who do you think would have rifled the survival pack?
Our own people on the ground. Our own servicing people. Take out chocolates and spare socks, spare uniforms, spare clothing.
Any other incidents that stick out?
I don't think so, because I only did half a tour there. I did 18 months there, and then I went up to Korea after that.
Which years do you think you were in Malaya?
First of all,
yes,
I was 51, 52 on my first tour.
How much of a threat to the survival of the British presence did you think the guerrillas were at that time?
Oh, a big threat. Big threat at one time. Yes. It was only when General Templer came out and started. Mind you, I think he was working on plans that had been laid out earlier, but at least he was the man who put them into operation. And he was the man who really stirred things up and got a little bit of backbone into the people and got things moving. He started putting troops actually in the jungle and moving all the local people, Chinese, out of the edge of the jungle into these villages.
Did you meet Tanfire?
Yes, yes, a couple of times, yeah.
Under what circumstances?
Well, we flew into a strip a couple of times when he was there visiting troops. And we didn't fly him in, but he'd come in with the RAF and helicopters. But I met him a couple of times out there.
What impression did he make?
Great impression. Very, a soldier's soldier. You could talk to him, and he would listen to you. And he seemed pretty straight. He had no airs and graces about him at all. I thought he was a great man.
Which other places did you operate in Malaya?
Well, I went back. I did two more tours back there. So the second time I went out there, I was stationed in Singapore then at the naval base, Sembawang. By then things had improved slightly. We'd got a better aircraft, an Austin 9, which had a metal prop, a bigger engine, and we got more sophisticated now. We got a bomb rack fitted underneath the aircraft for marking targets. This time we were marking for the Australians, who had the Lincolns. That was the bigger Lancaster. And we target marking from them, which was much better now, because with the flares, smoke flares, we could drop the smoke flare and then actually guide the bomber onto it, telling him whether it was sort of plus or minus of the smoke and this kind of thing. So that was better. We got better information by then, of course. And of course at that time, the second time when I was out there, the terrorists were more or less, we got the top hand over them then. So things were improving.
This was the late 50s?
This would be 58, I think. Yes, around about 58 time when I went there then.
How did you come to be in the Korean War?
Well, we had a flight in Korea. The AeroP had a flight there for directing the guns, and they wanted a liaison flight. So 1913 flight went out there. Major Downward was commanding. He's now General Downward. He was a flight commander. He did a lot for Army aviation in Korea, because when he first went out there, I think the flight was looked on more as a nuisance than anything else, and it was only him that sort of started pushing it that really, really got people working and working hard there. And we had quite a successful time in Korea.
Was this still 656 Squadron?
No, we were an independent flight. It was part of 656 Squadron, but we were 1913 glider pilot flight, independent glider pilot flight. And we're all glider pilots there.
And where were you based in Korea?
On the Imjin River, not far, in fact, from Gloucester Valley. About a mile or two away from Gloucester Valley, a bit further down the river.
But this was after the...
After the Gloucesters, yes. We were there at the time of the Battle of the Hook, when the Dukes were there, and when the Black Watch were there. We were there through those battles.
In what way was it, do you say it was so successful?
We got quite a good name there. We were called on quite a lot. In fact, our demands sort of grew then, that we were getting more demands than we could cope with. So we did achieve a bit there. Did a lot of reconnaissance work. Later on, the artillery got us to do target marking as well, directing the guns. We'd done a little of that when we did our training, but they came down and gave us a quick briefing, and then we used to go up every morning on the first, what we called the dawn sortie, with prearranged targets. And then if you didn't find a target, which you very rarely did because the Chinese were so clever at hiding everything, then we shot at a prearranged target. And we took the infantry up and flew before they took patrols out. We'd fly them over the area during the day, so so they'd have some idea of that kind of country they were going to go over at night time with their patrols.
What do you remember about the Battle of the Hook?
Not an awful lot, because I saw it from the air. I saw part of it from the air. We could hear it, of course, where we were. We weren't too far away, so we could hear the artillery, and I actually saw the aircraft going in, swamping the area. We had the Navy fighters there, Sea Furies, that did attacks on it.
Did the enemy have any aircraft that were a menace to you?
American Air Force did. They bombed a bridge just downriver from us one morning. I was going up one morning on a sortie, and the next thing I saw is three American aircraft diving down and bombing the bridges. And we thought at first what's going on here, and then they turned out to be Americans. And then I was up on a sortie one morning. I got an infantryman in the back, infantry sergeant, and this American Sabre passed very close to me, flew right alongside me. And I knew that the O was operated in pairs, so I sort of looked round. I could see the other one diving down towards me. So I thought, oh, this is great, we're going to have a bit of fun here. And so we had a dogfight, lasted about 5-10 minutes, I suppose, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I thought it was great fun, these two sabres trying to get at me. Of course, being an Oster, I could turn on the sixpence, as it were, keep out of the way. And then they shot off, and after I'd finished my sortie, I came back and landed. And as I got out of the aircraft, my pal was coming towards me, Sergeant Jeremy, and I said, I just had great fun up there. I said, just, you know, we had 5 or 10 minutes flying around with two sabres and a dogfight. So I said, yes, they were trying to shoot you down. So, of course, my face dropped then. And I said, good heavens. And what had happened was that there'd been a report from the ground that there was a Russian or Chinese light aircraft dropping leaflets over the front. So they sent these two sabres up to inquire, and they'd flown alongside me, and they'd seen we had big squadron letters painted on the fuselage. Got these letters, and they'd phoned back to the command post and said, have you got an aircraft with, I don't know what it was, AWV on the side? And it was one of our clerks who was at the command post at the time. So he looked on the aircraft board, and of course he was looking at the aircraft identification letters, which are two letters and three numbers. He didn't think about these big letters that are painted on the side, so I said, no, it's not one of ours. So they said, right, fetch him down. And it was only when the duty pilot came in, sort of 5 minutes later, and said, anything happened? So they said, oh no, they've got an aircraft up there, WV or something, it's not one of ours, so they're going after it. So of course he immediately panicked and got him called off. That afternoon, two colonels from the American Air Force came to our strip to interview me, and said, did I want to make a complaint? So I said, no, as far as I was concerned, a bit of fun, I enjoyed it. So he said, what about the T-6? So I said, what about the T-6? He says, well, at the time we called you off, there was a T-6 on your tail, with his rockets armed, ready to fire. I never saw him at all. So that's why the Americans were more dangerous to me than the Chinese.
Sounds as if your own clerk didn't do you much of a favour.
No, mind you, you couldn't really blame him. I mean, he's only a young clerk. And he would, those big letters that were on, they were never referred to, really. It was only, if ever you talked about an aircraft, you used to say it was WX641 or something like that, the smaller numbers. On an aircraft, you may see it on modern, well, not modern aircraft, but on the sort of wartime aircraft. They would have squadron letters painted on the side, which would be big letters, and then at the back on the tail would be a five figures, WX and then the number, and that was the aircraft identification. So this is where the confusion arose.
Did you have the same handlebar moustache that you've got now when you were flying?
I did for a while. I did during the summer. And then I used to fly an L-19 there, an American aircraft, because I was the general's pilot. I was his personal pilot, so he didn't like flying in the Oster, so we actually borrowed an L-19 from the Americans, which was a better aircraft all round, and they painted it, camouflaged it for us, painted it in RAF colours. And but when you flew in that, in the winter time, being American, it was heated. And I used to get in there in the early morning with my tash all frozen. And after flying for about a quarter of an hour or so, it had all melted and dribbled. And in a fit of temper one day, I came back and chopped it off.
But did you have the moustache when those jets attacked you? Because I would have thought that would have given the game away that you weren't.
I don't suppose I would have noticed. I don't suppose I would have noticed that much, really. And we used to have another one. We used to call him Bedcheck Charlie. It was a little Russian aircraft, rather like a Harvard, I should think, two-seater, not very big. And this used to take off from northern Korea on the Chinese border during the day and fly halfway down Korea. And then at night time it used to bomb up and then fly down over the front and just drop a few bombs out and then go back, land, refuel, and it'd be back up in northern China again by the next morning. And he used to come over fairly regularly, around sort of 9, 10 o'clock at night, and that's why we called him Bedcheck Charlie. And of course, the predicted guns couldn't do much to him because he was flying too slow. But one night it achieved quite a great success. It bombed Incheon, which was the port, the American, where the Americans did their landing when they came in, and that thing that went. There's a big oil dump there, and he actually hit the oil dump and caused quite a bit of damage that night. So it was, for them, I should imagine, it was well worthwhile.
Was it ever shot down?
No, no.
Did you ever get enemy MiGs coming in?
Not as far down as where we were, no. We were mainly on the Chinese border. They very rarely came down Korea at all.
Which did you prefer, the work in Korea or that in Malaya?
Oh, I think Korea.
Why was that?
I think the spirit was good in Korea. It was a great... We were in the Commonwealth Division, which was with British, Canadian, Australian, New Zealand. We had an Indian medical unit. And the spirit in that division was absolutely marvellous. Everywhere you went... And the Commonwealth Division itself was held in great esteem by the Americans. The Americans thought a lot about it, mainly because of the Battle of the Gloucesters. For what they'd done there. But the spirit was terrific. And I think you find that the harder the conditions, the better the spirit with a unit. Usually works out that way. Because you're much more closely bound together, as it were.
Did you have any problems with the climate affecting the aircraft?
Yes, wintertime especially. It used to get so cold that before we could fly in the morning, we had these, eventually got these so-called heaters, but they weren't very good. But an ordinary aircraft, you'd maybe have to turn the propeller over 20, 25 minutes or more to get the oil loose enough to circle around. Because if you try to start the aircraft,